This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, historian and author Jim Gregory takes a look back to the World War II internment of local Japanese Americans.
A line of Greyhound buses appeared to pick up the residents of the South County of Japanese descent and take them to a relocation center.
Also, on Playing with Food, we learn how to prepare foods for Passover.
When you buy matzah in the store, they're square. And what we have made look like beautiful clouds.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 4th, 2022. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with CAP Radio host and former KCBX news director Randall White's conversation with politics reporter Nicole Nixon. They discuss the latest move by California lawmakers to protect renters from getting evicted. And also, we'll get an update on the state's gas tax.
So this really was down to the wire, so much so that Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis, who is currently stepping in for Governor Newsom, signed this into law?
Yeah, so the legislature passed and the Lieutenant Governor signed legislation that protects about 500,000 renters from being evicted. These are people who've fallen behind on rent. They applied for rent relief through the state's fund, but that fund has been slow to process these applications. And there's a couple hundred thousand people that are still waiting to have their applications processed. That deadline was Thursday, and this law was signed just hours before that deadline.
And this bill now protects those people.
Yes, this bill says these renters cannot be evicted while they wait for their rent relief, and they are protected through the end of June. And I should also note, though, that there are some Democratic San Francisco lawmakers who did not support this law. You know, the legislature has extended the eviction moratorium several times. This is not as widespread as those. But these San Francisco lawmakers oppose this because it preempts some local eviction bans. And as of now, there's nothing to address that and make it, you know, so cities can do their own sort of eviction bans.
So why was the governor not available to sign this?
Well, the governor is on vacation. His spokesperson said that after 2 years of handling, you know, the pandemic, wildfires, a recall, he had promised his kids a family trip to Central and South America. So while he is out, the lieutenant governor handles bill signings. And actually, the very first time in California state history, a woman has signed a bill into law.
Wow, a history-making day at the Capitol.
On the last day of Women's History Month, no less.
Right. So, Nicole, we've been keeping tabs on the battle over the gas prices and the gas tax. Was there any movement on that?
Yes. So something that happened earlier was that the bill by Republicans to suspend the state's 51-cent gas tax was finally scheduled for a hearing. But during that hearing, Democrats voted to gut the bill and replace it with something that would actually add an additional surcharge on oil companies when the price of gas is, quote unquote, abnormally high compared to the price of a barrel of oil, which is something Democrats argue is happening right now. You know, oil has fallen in price. We still have really high gas prices in California. And the idea is that oil companies would pay a tax on their profits, and that money would go into a fund to be rebated to consumers. Now, however, as you can imagine, Republicans were not too happy about this move. Assemblymember Kevin Kiley, he had the gas tax suspension bill. He said that, you know, Democrats are very out of touch if they think additional taxes will solve this problem.
California often has higher gas prices than the rest of the country, especially in some places like the Bay Area. What are we seeing right now?
Well, we see that gas prices are letting up just a little bit in California. The average is still about $5.88 a gallon.
That was CAP Radio's politics reporter Nicole Nixon talking with CAP Radio host and former KCBX news director Randall White. In April 1942, South San Luis Obispo County residents who were Japanese Americans were taken from their homes to a temporary relocation center in Tulare. Historian and author Jim Gregory talks about those days with KCBX's Tom Wilmer while they sit outside in Arroyo Grande.
80 years ago, on February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, authorizing the evacuation and relocation of all Americans of Japanese descent to internment camps far removed from the West Coast. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Central Coast historian Jim Gregory, author of World War II, Arroyo Grande. Gregory shares the sorrows and triumphs of the dramatic period in Arroyo Grande history, a time when more than 40% of the town's high school student body was of Japanese ancestry. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
The world turned upside down right here in Arroyo Grande on the Central Coast. Tell us about the game changer.
It would have been April of 1942, and it was the day before trout season, which is, if you're an Arroyo Grande boy, that's a date you kind of hold sacrosanct. Ken Cabarra remembered that. Ken Cabarra was Nisei, an American-born Japanese.
Second generation.
And that would have been the day when a line of Greyhound buses appeared about 200 yards from where we're sitting up on Crown Hill to pick up the residents of the South County of Japanese descent and take them to a relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. So this was the execution of Executive Order 9066.
Let's back up and let's rewind for a moment. December 7th, 1941 was a powerful, just mind-blowing day for everybody. And for the Japanese especially, the Nisei and Issei that lived here, it must have been a doubly horrific day for them.
It was. The news would have gotten here via CBS and Bob Trout about 11:30 in the morning. And about that time, the Ikeda family, who were Methodists, would have been, like most other families in Arroyo Grande, getting ready for Sunday lunch. It would become apparent within 2 weeks that we had already taken our first casualties. There were two Arroyo Grande sailors named Jack Scruggs and Wayne Morgan who were killed on Battleship Arizona. So for Arroyo Grandians, including our Japanese neighbors, the war came very quickly and very brutally.
The Nisei that you've talked with and interviewed that lived in the South County, after Pearl Harbor, what did they think? Did they have a sense that they would be interned and bussed away?
I don't think they did at first. They were certainly anxious. I spoke at great length with Haru Hayashi, who is a longtime farmer. His father came here from Japan. Haru was a sophomore in high school. At the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, he was recovering from appendicitis and was at home. So he was very anxious about returning to school after Pearl Harbor. When he did, he didn't feel any animosity. His closest friends, Don Gullickson, John Loomis, and Gordon Bennett, they were kind of the four musketeers. And the toughest kid at Arroyo Grande Union High School was an Italian-American kid named Milt Gugia. And he came up to Haru, took him aside and says, Haru, yes? Says, if anybody calls you a Jap, let me know and I will personally beat the crap out of them. So there was, at first, there was anxiety, but there wasn't the kind of anxiety that you would have anticipated being taken away from your home and sent far across the country.
The other dynamic of the South County of the Central Coast was the number of Japanese who lived here. As I recall, close to 50% of the students at Arroyo Grande High School were Japanese. That's incredible.
That's right. 25 of the 58 members of the class of 1942 were Nisei. And what's heartbreaking to me, since I grew up here, went to school in Arroyo Grande, later taught at Arroyo Grande High School, I knew many of these families, the Ikedas, Cabarras, Hayashis, the Fuchiwakis. But if you look in the annual from 1942, I don't recognize the surnames of many of these young people. It's estimated that fewer than half of the Japanese who were interned from Arroyo Grande would come back home after the war.
And the reasons why, was there any explanation why they moved away?
Well, near the end of the war in 1945, by then many of the young people had found jobs. They could leave the internment camps. They had employment in places like Chicago, for example. My friend Ben Dewey went to university in Missouri, Kazaketa top sugar beets in New Mexico and Utah. So many of them found jobs, and there was kind of a standing invitation in 1945 from the governor of Colorado, who recognized these were model citizens. So he extended an invitation for you West Coast Japanese, if you'd like to become Coloradans, you're more than welcome, and many of them did.
One of the disconnects of this moment in time, it's been said over and over again that in many respects, the Japanese Nisei and Sensei that lived on the Central Coast were in many ways as American or more American than the Americans. They very much melted into society, baseball, and when I talk about that Americanism of the Japanese that lived here.
You cite baseball, which Japanese Americans had a passion for, and one of the great stories, one of the great families of the Rio Grande area is the Loomis family. They owned an insurance agency and a farm supply store where I bought my baby chicks when I was a little guy. But Vard was a pitcher at Stanford. He graduated, came back into the family business, and Jusso Akeda, who's one of the farmers of the upper Rio Grande Valley, asked Vard if he would be interested in managing a team. And that team became the All Nisei Rio Grande Growers. And they were a terrific baseball team. Kaz Akeda, who was a catcher at Cal Poly, one of his brothers played infield at Cal Poly. They were among the team's stars. So they barnstormed throughout the Central Valley and up and down the California coast playing other Nisei teams. And they were a wonderful, wonderful team.
Talk a little bit more about the patriotic dimension of the Japanese here.
They were so completely integrated. Again, you can see that from the old high school yearbooks. They were student body officers. They were athletes, basketball, baseball, football. One of my favorite characters from the book I wrote about World War II Rio Grande was named George Nakamura. Nakamura was the sports editor of the Rio Grande Union High School newspaper, the High Chatter, and he would go on to win a Bronze Star. As an Army intelligence sergeant, he would rescue an American flyer who had been shot down in the interior of China. So Nakamura was not only a brilliant young man, he was engaging, and he never came back to Rio Grande, but he asked his son Gary to bring his ashes here to be buried.
Wow.
So he came home again.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Tom Wilmer is speaking with historian and author Jim Gregory about the events surrounding the internment of Japanese Americans living in Arroyo Grande in 1942.
Rewinding back, it's April 1942. We're in Arroyo Grande. And a line of Greyhound buses show up in town with United States Army bayonets fixed. The Japanese are loaded on the buses and taken away to Manzanar, Tule Lake, and other internment camps. And all of a sudden, hundreds of Japanese citizens of the Central Coast are gone, and their farms, their farmhouses are abandoned. Two things happen, negative and positive. Tell us about that aftermath.
As tragic as the so-called evacuation of the Japanese was, there were a lot of circumstances that really make me proud to be from Rio Grande. On the day the buses left, the Rio Grande Women's Club brought box lunches to the people who were about to leave. Many farmers and neighbors came out to say goodbye. One woman remembered a string of five or six high school girls, some Nisei, some Caucasian, walking up the hill to the Crown Hill campus, holding hands and crying. Then those buses came down the hill and they went along Branch Street. So all the businesses and stores that these kids had grown up with, ending with the two churches, Methodist and Catholic, just before you get on 101, they didn't know whether they would ever see these places again. And in fact, many of them never did. They would be taken to a temporary relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. We hear of the Japanese who slept in poor stalls at Santa Anita. San Luis Obispo County's Japanese slept in animal stalls that had been used for exhibitions during the Tulare County Fair, and they still stank of manure. They would stay there for several months, and what they would do during those 3 or 4 months at Tulare was incredible. They started a newspaper. They formed baseball and softball leagues. They started their own schools. They formed their own self-governing kind of city council. And what they achieved in that short amount of time before they were ultimately sent to their permanent camp was simply remarkable. They created a community.
Back to here in town and in the country, their farms, some of them were just getting ready to plant.
Right.
Their houses were abandoned. And there were incidents where people came and broke into their houses and stole all their belongings. Yeah. There were also touching stories. Mr. Loomis, for example, talked to us
The Loomis family the book I wrote about World War II is dedicated to one of the Loomises, Joe, who is a dear friend of mine growing up here. It has always been noted for its selflessness, and World War II was no exception. The Loomis brothers, who ran the family business, E.C. Loomis and Son, watched over the property and the farm equipment of several families, the Fukuharas and the Akedas included. Pete Pacino, who was an insurance agent who was tragically killed, he was a Cal Poly booster, was killed in the 1960 Toledo plane crash, took care of his Japanese customers' cars for the duration. There were others, Silveras, Phelans, Taylors. These families, to use a cliche, really stepped up to the plate and, again, watched over their neighbor's property and their equipment. When Haru Hayashi, who I mentioned before, came back from the war, he found that he pretty much could pick up right where his father had left off in 1942 because of this. And it wasn't entirely successful. There was an old dehydration shed that the Loomis brothers used to store furniture and other personal belongings of their Japanese friends. That was broken into, the examples like the ones you cite, and much of that stuff was either vandalized or stolen during the war.
What other most touching, memorable things do you recall of all your studies and conversations?
Since I'm a former Rio Grande High School teacher, I'm very, very proud of the then principal, a young man named Clarence Burrell. And I'm very close to the Fujiwaki family. I went to high school with two of the daughters of Hilo Fujiwaki, who was served in Army intelligence. Well, one Fujiwaki daughter was kind of the babysitter for Clarence Burrell's small children. Another worked as a secretary at the high school. When he began to intuit that there would be an evacuation, this would have been about this time of year, February in 1942, he had the course of study accelerated for the Nisei sophomores so they could graduate on time. Because they were taken away before graduation, they didn't get their diplomas. So Burrell put their diplomas in his car and personally drove to the Tulare County camp. And in a little ceremony, he conferred the diplomas on the class of 1942. That took a tremendous amount of moral courage. This was not a popular thing to do at the time. Other examples, toward the end of the war, when the Kabara family was one of the first to come back, they were fairly established, and they would kind of shepherd the other families as they returned gradually from Gila River, which is where our neighbors wound up. Mrs. Kabara came into a store to do some shopping for her family and the other families they were taking care of. There were several. They'd been turned down, by the way. They were also taking care of Santa Maria families because no hotel in Santa Maria would allow them to stay in 1945. Mrs. Kabara did her grocery shopping, and then the proprietor of the store, I don't know which store it was, I don't particularly want to know, told her to never come back again. Now, one of the women...
This was after?
This was right after the war, yeah.
Oh.
Right. The head of the Rio Grande Women's Club was Mrs. Taylor, who was the wife of a prominent local farmer. She was outraged. And I don't know what she said at the next meeting of the Rio Grande Women's Club, but I think it peeled the wallpaper off the walls. Kimi Kabara, the woman who was told never to come back, said that the atmosphere improved immediately. And for me personally, as a teacher, the payoff was wonderful because I got to teach two of Eileen Taylor's great-grandchildren and three of Kimi Kabara's great-grandchildren.
The healing process, how long did it take?
In some ways, It's difficult to tell. The problem is that the people who were interned internalized so much. My peers growing up, Sansei, third generation, their parents refused to talk about the camp experience. Mm-hmm. And it was only as many of them began to get into their 80s and 90s that they began talking to informants, oral historians, Cal Poly students who gathered some wonderful interviews. So some of that, I think, is still there. It's deeply submerged. But this was something that cut Rio Grande very deep.
Jim Gregory, always a pleasure to visit and learn from you. If somebody wanted to learn more about you and your writings and your books as they relate to Central Coast history,
you can either go to my website, which is very simple to find, riograndehistory.com, or I have an author page on amazon.com that talks more about my two books about local history.
Excellent. Jim Gregory, thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Rio Grande, California.
During World War II, there were people assigned to rescue cultural and artistic monuments. In California today, heritage resources are rescued from harm during emergencies like fire, earthquakes, and floods. Tom Wilmer talks with Colonel Kirk Sturm about the Heritage Emergency Response Team.
Tell us about something that got your attention.
Tom, the movie The Monuments Men depicts service members during World War II finding heritage resources that were plundered, identifying those and returning them to their rightful owners. So the Monuments Men program is with the U.S. Army, and it protects cultural resources during armed conflict.
So that still exists?
It still exists. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
But there were some failures when we invaded Iraq. There was a failure to guard the museums there. Has there been a learning curve?
I don't know the circumstances mm-hmm. of the failure, but I do know that starting in about 2015, the U.S. Army has spun up its Monuments Men program.
So you have taken that model and created the HERT, the Heritage Emergency Response Team. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Heritage Emergency Response Team, or HERT, lives in the California Military Department with the California State Guard. And it takes the concepts of the Monuments Men, and remember, that's during armed conflict,
right.
And it applies the same concepts inside the state of California during emergencies.
So it might be civil disturbance, it might be earthquake, it might be fire, it could be any...
any one of those mm-hmm. events that negatively impacts heritage resources, the HERT could be called through the Office of Emergency Services to respond and protect those heritage resources.
It's a complex organization because you have to have prior training and tutorial on how to respond.
Yes. Yay. On one hand, it's a very simple concept. There is this group of service members in California that can respond to the 4,000 or so heritage institutions in California. You've got libraries, museums, archives that are operated by tribal and local and state organizations. So it is a complex, but it's simple in that you can break it into chunks. The military's great at that, breaking it into chunks and having those chunks work together as a team to accomplish the mission. And again, it's protecting heritage resources during the disaster itself, or after the disaster, during the initial few weeks of the recovery phase.
So you're in progress. A few months ago, I was embedded with you for a three-day training seminar, hands-on, at Camp San Luis Obispo, where you were teaching Smithsonian protocol on salvaging paper artifacts and hard artifacts.
Yes. You know, one of the tenets of emergency management in America is all hazards. And so we've kind of taken that one step farther. We say that the HERT is an all hazard, all artifact emergency response team.
Mm-hmm.
So we do training. There's a core amount of training where we're gonna cover 95% of all the things we might expect. And it could be smoke damage, water damage, it could be just the actual need to protect those artifacts. For example, if there's an earthquake and half of the building is gone, that's going to interfere with security, mm-hmm. right, for those heritage institutions.
We're talking about HERT under the umbrella of the California State Guard.
Yes.
Right? So primary responders, either in direction or coordination. It could be that the State Guard would then call on the National Guard to have a group respond to a specific location.
Yeah, so the California Military Department has a 150-year history of responding to incidents to help Californians and to help the local communities during a disaster or recovery. And the HERT would be the organization that's primarily responding. But then the HERT also, not only does it travel with subject matter experts that can help with the heritage resources, security, we can help with emergency paperwork or evacuation plans, etc. But we then can be the point that's seeing what's going on.
Command and control, coordination, direction.
Yes, to help the local agencies be successful. We don't think things over.
Right.
We support their success.
So the fire department locally might respond under your direction. True?
The fire department might respond to put out a fire during an earthquake, let's say. But then after they're done, I'm not picking on firefighters, but they have this pesky habit of spraying water everywhere, right? And that could be on heritage resources.
Right.
So then that local agency can call their Office of Emergency Services and go through the proper channels. And we could come and during that emergency, we could help that agency protect their resources. To follow on to answer your question more directly, if we needed more resources, then we have this ability to kind of reach back inside of the military department and then reach back to California Office of Emergency Services to get additional resources. Again, we are in a support role, Tom, to help those local agencies be successful.
Okay, let's set up a scenario. The History Museum in San Luis Obispo, the old Carnegie Library.
Okay.
That facility, like so many museums around the state, around the country, where do they store archival stuff?
Most of it's in the basement.
In the basement. So now let's throw in a flood, and you know you need to respond and extract and salvage that fragile paper.
Right.
What's the protocol? What happens? You get a call, flood at History Museum. Then what happens?
Right.
Who do you notify?
It's going to go through the Office of Emergency Services and then come over to us in the California Military Department, and then we're going to respond, our team, and our first priority is to arrive on site and talk to the museum director, the librarian, the archivist that's in charge of that facility, and to say, we're here to support you. What are your priorities? And when those are written down or they can be articulated, fine. If not, we travel with some default priorities where we could suggest things. Imagine that this is a stressful time. And so to the extent that we can come on scene with some things written down ahead of time or checklists or protocols written down that can help people make better decisions.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We're visiting with Colonel Kirk Sturm of the California State Military Guard, talking about a new program called HERT, Heritage Emergency Response Team.
Part of the protocol of HERT would be for us to go around to different museums and meet with the archivist and talk about their protocol?
Yeah, even before that, it would be doing some planning work or some mitigation work and seeing if these, you know, 4,000 heritage institutions have an emergency operations plan or have a prioritized evacuation list, right? And then back to your question, whatever the goals were, then we can help. We can bring people, we can bring equipment, we can bring supplies. In the scenario you mentioned, there's a basement, right? So we can bring dewatering equipment and get the water out, and then we'll start the salvage activities, again, to help that local heritage institution be successful. We can also perform initial damage assessments because this is happening as part of an earthquake or some other triggering event that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
Then we can feed that information up to the local jurisdiction so we can make sure this heritage institution gets included in damage assessment reporting.
In the three-day training that we went through, you showed how to squeegee off the paper safely. But then phase two of that paper, you have to transport it to a dehydration plant. So how are they locked and loaded? Are they ready to receive us on a moment's call?
So Tom, we are following, you know, national guidelines on best practices. And those guidelines come from the Smithsonian. And that is the protocol for most wet objects, is to get them boxed, transported to a commercial freeze-dry facility.
And that would be, Fresno would be the closest?
I don't know for San Luis Obispo. Also, a GIS database would tell us where they were. We also have to consider things like, did the earthquake damage something? So it would be the closest one that's operating or outside of the area of impact.
implied with that is a prior meetup with the dehydration plants.
Yes.
Oh. So they're ready and locked and loaded to receive us.
Right. Yeah. So you're teasing out this very simple concept of let's protect California's heritage resources, mm-hmm. and you're teasing out some of the complexity to do that. But that's all in our wheelhouse. That's right. What we do.
Right. And again, one tangent there would be you need vehicles. You need a box truck. You need a couple Humvees maybe, you know, to move people around. Is that ready to go? What's the protocol when you call Camp San Luis Obispo? We need X, Y, and Z.
Right. So we're going to figure out where it is and what makes the best sense to spin that up, right? Also, remember, we're not acting in a vacuum. This is going through local Office of Emergency Services to regional to state, mm-hmm. and then over to the California Military Department. So along the way, they're going to be prioritizing where we're going and what we're doing, right, for us to respond. And then once we know where that is and what's going on, we can help. We have the capabilities, Tom, to do that. We are in an effort to expand the capacity to do that, mm-hmm. on a grander scale. We'd like to be able to have two of these HERT teams in Northern California, mm-hmm. and two of these HERT teams in Southern California. And we're on a growth pattern, right? It's headed in that direction.
A while back when I attended the 3-day training, it was all State Guard. Going forward, would you have that same sort of training for National Guard State?
Again, it depends more than the National Guard. Yes to the National Guard, and then we put a comma there, and.
But they would be one of your primary responders if you have a reservist who's locked and loaded and ready and motivated to respond. They're going to be one of your primary body sources, aren't they?
Correct. As well as local volunteers. Sure. Maybe that library or archive or museum has a volunteer force, or the community might come out to support. So one of our capabilities is managing volunteers. And again, we can ask for additional resources. And if it's the National Guard, we're always going to provide a heritage resource awareness and safety. It's surprisingly dangerous, you know, when you're going down into the basements and entering with stuff. Things are safest when they're like in the... Like if it's a painting and it's behind glass, that's the safest state. But when, mm-hmm. the earthquake comes on, it falls to the ground, then we have to start worrying about safety.
Then you have physical safety. We talked about the LA riots, and there was some intrusion into museums by thieves. So you have to have security.
Correct. That's one of our, I forget what we have, a 9 or 11 core capabilities is security. It's securing the buildings that we're in. It's securing artifacts and transport and protecting the people that are there still operating the museum. If you'd like to join the California State Guard to help us respond to protect these heritage resources in California, you can jump on to the California State Guard website and you'll find the museum command, and there's information there on how to join. This is important. When you look at what happens in armed conflict, what's the first thing opposing forces do is destroy symbolic symbols, heritage symbols. And so in this instance, it's, you know, earthquakes or fires that are doing that. Mm-hmm. But we have to protect California's heritage resources, because those heritage resources are the voices of the people of the state of California.
Let's wheel back in time for a moment. Kirk Sturm is a colonel in the California State Guard. You served in the National Guard?
No. I was like so many Californians that wanted to do something to benefit the state of California, but not necessarily be involved with armed conflict. And so that's why the California State Guard made a lot of sense for me.
When did you join the State Guard?
2013.
Okay, so today you live in Los Osos, California?
Yeah, San Luis Obispo County. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and... You teach at Cal Poly, right?
Yes, I teach part-time at Cal Poly since 20 years ago.
You have a law degree?
I do. I actually have a master's degree in public administration. Mm-hmm. I've got a JD in law, and I've got a PhD in education.
Wow, very cool. So how do you apply that at Cal Poly?
I initially was coming there. My background is in heritage resources, which is why this HERT team makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. I work for the California State Parks. And
you were at Hearst Castle, right?
I was at Hearst Castle, yeah. Yes. And so that's where I got my bug for heritage and got my bug for historic structures, mm-hmm. right? Historic monuments. So it was great because Cal Poly could ask somebody from the state parks to come and teach, and that's kind of how I got started with them.
And again, if somebody wants to learn more about California State Guard's mission of historic preservation, where do you direct them?
Grab your favorite search engine and search for California State Guard, and you'll end up on the homepage, and that describes the State Guard overall, and then move around to the Museum Command, and that's where the HERT lives inside of the military department.
One more, taking your model nationwide. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, the Smithsonian is the one that's leading the nation with these efforts. And, you know, they're on the East Coast. And so what we're trying to do is work with the Smithsonian. They coach and advise us.
So that being said, every state in the Union today has a parallel model in place that they're working on?
Tom, as far as I know, this is the first one in the nation.
Okay, so you will be a role model by default.
We'll be a role model by default.
Yeah.
There is a group called a National Organization for State Guard Entities. I think 21 states or so have a state defense force, and presented this concept at their annual conference last year.
Colonel Kirk Sturm with the California Military Department of the State Guard, thank you so much.
Tom, it's my pleasure. Thanks for being curious about this program to protect California's heritage resources.
My pleasure and honor.
On today's Playing with Food from the KCBX Archives, Father Ian Dellinger learns to prepare traditional foods for Passover.
Ilu ilu hotzianu, hotzianu mimitzrayim, hotzianu mimitzrayim dayenu.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food. It's spring, and the Jewish festival of Passover is not far away. And with every Jewish festival, there is food. Central to this festival is the Seder plate.
Seder means order. And the idea behind a Seder is you sit with family and friends and you tell the story of the Exodus and you pray and you thank God for freedom. We have traditional things on the Seder plates. We have parsley, which we dip in salt water, which symbolizes the tears of the slaves. A roasted lamb shank bone, which symbolizes the killing of the firstborn Egyptians. Horseradish, which is a bitter herb, mm-hmm. an egg, which symbolizes new life and rebirth.
The unleavened bread symbolizes that the Israelites did not have time for the bread or to leaven or to rise.
That bread is called matzah. And one more item on the plate is haroset. Robin Friedman O'Leary and Judy Harris showed me how to make this delicious, treat, mixture, condiment. Not sure what category it's in. But it's important to a Seder, and it's delicious. We also made matzah crackers, each of us for the first time, and I helped them reimagine what can be done with these delicious and symbolic foodstuffs. We are truly playing with food.
I'm Judy Harris. I'm an educator, now retired. Today I'm making haroset.
I'm Robin Friedman O'Leary, and I'm the office administrator at Congregation Beth David and a longtime congregant. And today I'm making Ashkenazi haroset.
Okay, mine is Sephardic, stemming from Spain, but today I'm making a Moroccan from Marrakesh haroset. Mine is with dates, walnuts, and wine.
And mine is a more traditional Eastern European haroset, which is just apples, walnuts, wine, and I use nutmeg. But some people use cinnamon, but I like to use a little nutmeg.
Haroset is how it's pronounced, and it is a Hebrew word meaning clay. When I grew up, we called it mud because it's very thick and binds together. It is spelled differently in the Sephardic, H-A-R-O-S-E-T.
And in Ashkenazi, it's haroset with a C-H. But I think the difference there is that when you Americanize it, it's called haroset. That's kind of the English version of it. And then haroset would be a transliteration of the Hebrew for it.
So we've got this clay, we've got this mud. What is it for?
That's one of the symbols of Passover. We have bitter herbs, lamb shank, egg, parsley, and that's dipped in salt water. And then the mud or clay, representing the mortar of rebuilding the temple.
Oh, see, and I always was told that it represented the mortar that was used to build the pyramids in Egypt because it's the story of Exodus. But see, that's one of the interesting things about Judaism is because of the diaspora and because the Seder plate is a symbolic device. I think earlier it was a mnemonic device. You know, before everybody could read and write, I think the Seder plate was used to help people remember the symbols of the Exodus. And so that's probably where the differences come in. But it probably does stand for both when you think about it in the end. And it is somewhat sweet, depending on how you make it, but a thick, chunky mixture really good on a cracker.
Which is commonly called matzah, an unleavened bread. I'll start with mine. There are basically three ingredients in the haroset from Marrakesh, Morocco. It's sweet wine. I'm using manischewitz, walnut, and dates. And I've prepared a mixture that has been pureed.
You're going to actually make it or are you going to just
No,
spit it
it's
out?
Already been made. Okay. I'm just showing you the pre-wine version of this. You can see it was pureed in the Cuisinart. It just kind of looks like what? Crumbs.
This bowl here has the chopped dates, the chopped nuts, and not the wine.
And so I'll mix that up. You can see how it is binding together.
Super, super simple.
Yes, very simple. There are four other recipes I have in the Sephardic cookbook. A Turkish haroset, it's cooked. There's an uncooked Turkish haroset. Greek from Rhodes. Moroccan from Marrakesh, which is what I'm making. Moroccan haroset from Tutuna. And Egyptian haroset. And most of these have apples, pitted dates, almonds, vinegar, wine, cinnamon. Much like what Robin is making, but mine is what I grew up with. My mother was from Tiberias, Israel, but originally from Morocco. So she made this one, the pitted dates, walnuts, and sweet wine. And we, as children, called it mud. We didn't know it was even called haroset.
Well, let me see what Robin is doing over here.
The first thing I did was I took some walnuts and put them in the toaster oven because they just need to be lightly toasted. There's something about baking them that mellows the flavor out just a little bit. Then I'm going to take some apples. And what we like to do in my family is we like to get a variety of apples. We don't stick with just one kind of apple. But I like to make sure that they're nice. They don't have wax on them because we leave the skin on. Chop them up. So I think one of the best ways to explain this is that most Jews in America came from Eastern Europe. So most of our recipes are Eastern European recipes, which is why this haroset is something I think most of us are familiar with. And Judy's is so unique. The Eastern European Jews were the biggest wave of immigrants to America in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and certainly after World War II. So you just want to pulse it just a little bit. It's supposed to be kind of chunky, not applesaucy.
This is in preparation for Passover and for the Seder plate, but you eat this on a cracker. Do you eat this at any other time of year? Will you make this just spontaneously?
No, it has so many calories. I would and it's too delicious and tempting to eat. So no.
Not often, but my kids really like it. And so sometimes they'll say, oh, can you just make a little bit, you know, and they like to put it in their school lunches. But it's more of a special holiday food like latkes are for Hanukkah. All right, got my apples chopped.
Your walnuts are coming up.
My walnuts are coming up. So this is where not having a recipe comes into play, because what you do is you take your walnuts now and you just eyeball it. Some people like equal ratios. Just depends on what your family likes. All right, so then we'll just pour that in there. Oh. We've got a Central Coast Zinfandel, and it's really lovely. You judge how much you're using by the color. And if you have kids, I always make a version with just grape juice for the kids, because you don't cook the wine out, so eat too much of this and you'll feel it. I like to grate a little bit of whole nutmeg on there. All right, so you just grate. And can you smell? All right, and that's it. I mean, that's how easy it is. And you can taste it. And if
so that's done.
That's done.
But that's not like mud or clay.
No, it isn't. It's completely different from the Sephardic type of haroset. It's okay. Very different. And so I didn't even know about Sephardic haroset until I was almost an adult.
And so I didn't know about yours until I was an adult.
So shall we try these delectables?
You know, there's a couple ways you can try them. You can just put them straight on the matzah. Or what my family likes to do is make something called a halal sandwich.
Okay, well, let's start with the matzah.
Okay.
We'll try each one on the matzah.
Okay. Here's the Sephardic haroset.
Okay.
And you may put some on the matzah, and as much as you want or as little as you think you can handle.
Three simple ingredients. Mm-hmm. That's very nice.
You like it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As somebody who's not Jewish and isn't celebrating Passover, I could see this being a condiment for a cheese platter. Very nice.
One thing you should know, this keeps forever.
I'd imagine.
In the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now that you've brought that up, I think I will keep it in the refrigerator and add it to a cheese platter. What a great idea. Mm. Thank you.
You learned something.
Now I'll make it throughout the year again.
That's right. Why my show is called Playing with Food.
Okay.
So now we have the Ashkenazi.
Right.
And it's much more loose.
Right.
And it's a lighter color.
And it's chunkier.
Okay, here we go. The nutmeg is what I taste first. That's what happens when you grate nutmeg.
There's almost too much nutmeg in this one.
It's definitely not sweet. It's nice. I think this one would also be in a cheese platter. And this would balance the really, really strong cheeses.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to hold a temple together.
No, this isn't. Or a pyramid.
Or a pyramid.
Nothing. Nothing like that. It's easy to make, and I encourage you to go home and try it yourself. Mm-hmm. Break out a nice bottle of wine and make yourself some haroset.
Yeah.
The wine might not end up in the haroset.
Exactly.
Well, there's plenty. You only use a half a cup of wine for all of this ingredient, for a pound of dates and 2 cups of walnuts. So plenty of wine to taste after that.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is the Sephardic haroset is the sobering haroset, whereas the Ashkenazi haroset is the... not so sobering haroset. On Passover, we eat a halal sandwich. So you take a piece of matzah, you put some horseradish on it, and then you put some, usually I do it with the Ashkenazi haroset, and then you put another piece of matzah on top and you eat it. They go together beautifully.
But I think because horseradish is so spicy, I might use the Sephardic because it's sweeter. It'll go down easier for me.
Okay, well, let me give this a try.
How much horseradish can you handle?
Oh, a lot. I love horseradish. Oh, you're making me the sandwich? Yeah, I'll try both.
There you go.
Here we go. Here, we're going to try the Ashkenazi one with a lot of horseradish. That is really nice, actually.
Good.
Okay, let me try one with the other. I'm not doing well with the matzah over here.
Nobody ever does. Don't feel bad.
Yeah, matzah is everywhere when you eat matzah. What do you think?
It's good. It's very different. It does cut through the horseradish more.
Yes, it does.
This one is more horseradish forward because it's a lighter condiment, and that one's heavier.
Now remember, by the time you would eat this during a Seder, you were at least 1 to 2 glasses in of wine.
That's right.
You know, sometimes you could be a little more liberal with your horseradish because you aren't thinking.
Do you know anybody who makes matzah?
I have tried. What have I tried? I thought about trying. I think I was starting to, and I realized it's really hard because it rises fast. Even if you don't use yeast, flour will rise on its own. Mm-hmm. And so you have to really stand there and watch. And
It never occurred to me to make matzah ever in a million years. It was something I bought of, and I have made bread and I love to cook, but I was watching a cooking show and someone was making matzah and they put weights on the dough and cooked it with the weights on and then removed the weights and continued cooking it. And she had a stack, this chef, I forget her name, stack of matzah. They were not rectangular or square. They were just, you know, free form. It was interesting. I bet they were delicious.
Neither Judy nor Robin had ever made matzah, so I invited them over to my house to give it a try. We are now in my house because we decided that it would be exciting to make matzah. So that's what we're going to do today, right?
Yeah.
So Judy's with me. Robin couldn't be with me. We're going to make matzah, and then we're going to try it with cheese and crackers and haroset, right? Because we thought that was a good idea last time we talked. Yes. But you found out some more information about matzah?
I did. Matzah was the food of the Israelites, and they took it with them on their exodus. But because they had to leave so quickly, they didn't have time for it to leaven. And we eat it every Passover for 7 days. And so we will get started making matzah today. I've never made matzah. I've only purchased it. So this was an adventure.
So we have some that's made from plain flour and one from Karashan wheat, which is one of those ancient grains. So it could have been one of the grains that they made it out of.
Absolutely.
And that's organic and grown locally, this Karashan wheat.
Oh.
So we have some salts and we have some water. That's it, flour, salt, and water.
And you're using kosher salt.
Sure. Wink, wink. Can't remember what the box says. On the mixer, and it said add the water slowly. Get it the consistency of pizza dough, which it'll need a little bit more water, won't it?
That's it. No, I think that's good. It just needs more time.
Okay. You sure it doesn't need a little bit more water?
Well, let's stop it by feel. No, I think that's good.
You think that's good?
Feel it.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's moist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Okay, now you see the pizza dough consistency. Falling up. See that?
Yeah.
It just needed more time. I think we're good.
You think we're good?
I think we are.
Okay.
Any more, it would get rubbery.
But we'll put it in the bowl, and then we'll do this other one really quickly. All this one might require more flour because it's...
You need more water.
More water because it's a different type of flour.
Yes.
Turn it on.
Okay, this does need a little more water,
I think.
It's already balling up.
There we go.
Slow it down a little bit.
Okay.
Let's check the moisture level.
How's
yeah, that's going to be fine.
Okay. You said you'd never made this before, but you seem to be an expert.
Well, I bake quite a bit. I'm familiar with the consistency of dough. I make cookies too, and this is, and pizza dough. And.
Well, let's move to the other room.
Okay.
One of the things I noticed is that they all have fork holes, and even though this recipe doesn't say that, the picture that accompanies the recipe has a little fork hole, so we each have a fork.
Either that or you have to put weights on it so it doesn't rise, because all flour has a rising component to it, and this is an unleavened bread, so either we put weights on it or we fork it.
Just roll it out. You've never done this. This sounds like something that you could do with your family.
I could have. I never even thought about it.
This is something you can talk about at synagogue next Friday.
Yes, I can.
You can start the matzah circle.
That's a great idea. I could make it with the school children, the religious school children.
Is that enough?
I think so. Okay. Yes, and mine's small, but I'm going to leave it like that because I like the thickness of it.
Okay, this is very soft, this Karashan wheat one. I'm going to fork
it. So, yeah, let's just fork it. Make it easy. I don't know what weights you have available.
Cast iron pan.
Okay. All right.
Okay. How simple was that?
That was very simple.
Very simple. So we have to just make sure we don't burn them.
When you buy matzah in the store, they're square. And what we have made look like beautiful clouds. Different shapes with rounded corners. They're not rectangular at all.
Okay, so put them in the oven. I'll put mine on the bottom. Here's on the top. And it said like 3 minutes. It's on 500.
Wow.
And we just wait for 3 minutes.
Okay.
I am paranoid that it's gonna burn.
500 is very hot.
It's very hot, but you gotta trust the recipe.
On bake, it's 500. I don't think my oven goes to 500. Well, they look pretty good so far.
Okay, well, there's the timer.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's see what happens here. Let's see. It's gonna take a little bit longer, I think, because of the different type of flour, so.
Okay.
It's not 100% crisp.
No, see, it's not done.
Okay, let's turn it over.
Yeah,
because one of the recipes said, turn it over and put it back in.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, those look really good.
Oh, so these are the Karashan wheat ones.
Yeah, they made a really nice matzah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, these are really good. I'm going to taste these.
Now, let's move them back to the dining room. They look good.
Yes, they look very good.
I don't think the white ones are going to be crispy.
The recipe called for 3 minutes.
For 3 minutes,
I think longer on the white for sure, but the others are very nice and crisp.
Do you want to snap it?
Sure.
It snaps? It tears.
It tears. It doesn't snap. There might be another one that does snap, like that one.
Okay, try that one.
See, in the middle, there's still... Oh, that one a little better. So they clearly need more than 3 minutes.
Okay.
I'd say.
Okay.
This is a Sephardic Harofit with the dates and walnuts and sweet wine. Here you are.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And I'm going to try it myself. I like the Harofit. The matzah is a little chewy.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You think?
I'm flexible on the matzah.
The edges are really crisp and they are very flavorful.
Yeah.
It has the right amount of salt. I think a little more cooking would be good.
Mm-hmm. And these are the Kharoshan wheat ones, right?
Mm-hmm,
and you're going to try your Harofit with the blue cheese.
Okay.
These are California cheeses. One is local and two are Sonoma County. So how is it with the blue cheese? So have I reinvented Harofit for you? Because you've heard of eating it with cheese before.
Mm-mm. Delicious.
But we need to try it with wine, of course.
Of course.
This is a Riesling. Okay, so which one are you going to try now?
Okay, I think I'll try the cheddar. And I'm going to try the white flour matzah.
And to be fair to Robin, even though she's not here, we should try it with the other one as well.
Yes, I'll try the Ashkenazi with the apples.
Okay.
And the nutmeg walnuts.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Riesling? I've just redone Passover for you.
Yes, you have.
What a great combination. Mm-hmm. So, your assessment of matzah making, is this something that you're going to do again?
No. This was very enjoyable. It's too easy to go to the store and buy crisp matzah. I will do it with my grandchildren and the school children, but, you know, making it for the Passover meal, probably not.
Come Passover, you can make a double batch of your Harofit.
Mm-hmm.
You can get with the school children and make some matzah crackers.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the entire month of May, you can just sit out on the back porch with your wine and your extra leftover Harofit and your leftover matzah and have a nice time with your husband.
Yes.
How's that sound?
Sounds wonderful. L'chaim.
Our Playing with Food was preparing for Passover. Within their own faith, there was a cultural exchange between Ashkenazi and Sephardic, and we discovered a new way to eat and share Harofit and matzah. That's why I love Playing with Food. I'm Father Ian. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.